Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. We've been gone for a while, but we're back, and you know, it's been a adventure, so to speak, the last couple of days. We're here. We have a very special guest with us today, and as you guys know, you know, we've been now for 5+ years doing the show. No commercials, no sponsors, no GoFundMes, no extra people in here, and we managed to make this show work. And I think that for missing 7 shows in 5 years is pretty good. As you all know, I've got things going on that, you know, take time for me, and I got to get away. But I want to say good morning to everybody on Facebook. Appreciate everybody being here. We got two of our co-hosts in the house today, and we got a very special guest. So I'm going to go first up to Big Joe and say, good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. Let's get it.
All right, bro. Good morning, Chief. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. Ready to get back out here. Missed you guys last, what, 3-4 weeks?
Yeah.
So, ready to go.
And without further ado, we have to go down to our guest, Dr. Carmen Johnson. This lady is phenomenal. She actually came to me through the Judge Joe Brown show. And in reading her story and hearing what she went through, it's not just telling of the sign of the times, but her tenacity, her willingness to rebuild her and do her so she can help other people is a testimony that I think, you know, really needs to be said. And we're honored today to have her with us. Good morning, Dr. Carmen. How are you?
I'm doing just pleased to be here.
And you know, we're pleased to have you. We live in some times today where it's questionable as to how just the justice system is. And I think that when people who don't have income express that sentiment, it's overlooked. I think personally that there aren't enough people in the profession of law enforcement and the legal system willing to speak out against injustice and outside of a soundbite and take action. And that's what we do here. Our show is dedicated to the voice of the least. When we talk about drug addiction, we bring drug addicts. When we talk about prostitution, we bring former and current prostitutes. You know, we bring people who have the experience. And I'm going to tell you, you've run the full gamut. You have the floor. Take your time. Tell your story, because somebody's going to grow from listening to you today.
Okay, so... you just want me to just...
Yes, ma'am. We free flow here. We just having a combo.
I guess I first want to just start off with the fact that I'm a Tazit prisoner. I suffer from PTSD, chronic, from what I've seen, and anxiety. So I have the two handsome men here, Joseph and Jim. And, you know, one looks like a police officer, the other looks like a bad agent. So I'm a little nervous. That's part of the process of healing and part of this sabbatical and journey that I'm on. I just wanted to be, you know, transparent with that. But I would like to start off with the fact that I am a practicing Buddhist, and I'm a scholar of metaphysics, science of the mind, and mental science. And so I believe in, you know, laws of attraction, cause and effect, and things of that nature. And I've been living this lifestyle for almost 30 years. And I grew up in Pentecostal. And then when I became an adult, I left that faith and started on my new journey with my new belief. And, you know, I also became an entrepreneur, and I learned from the best, which when I learned how to run a legitimate business and have awesome bookkeeping skills, and I learned that from the Jewish community. And so when what I'm getting ready to talk about happened to me, it just really blew my mind. And it would blow anyone's mind. And the moral of my story and my sabbatical is the fact that it could happen to you. And that's the scary part, and that's the part that people don't, they don't think about, because I never thought about it. I never thought about a crime or committing a crime or doing anything against, you know, our country or, you know, our people, anyone. As a Buddhist, we, you know, can't even hurt an ant if we see it crawling on the ground. However, I became a successful entrepreneur, and I started a company called Able Estate and Company. And that was years ago, in about 1998. And this company offered financial credit restoration, debt arbitration, financial planning, preparation for bankruptcy, rehabilitation after bankruptcy. We gave out small loans, 5-10 offsets on people's credit reports, and having a relationship with over 2,000 creditors at that time, we were able to get pennies on the dollar. And we also had our first secured credit card way before Russell Simmons had a rush card. And I can say that I was a woman that was I'm probably came before it was time, you know. So I'm living in a weird time and era. I'm a little advanced. That's why you see the universe behind me here, or planet, or whatever you want to call it, space. And so we also was a member of Equifax, TransUnion, and Xfinity. And we offered Paramount services to regular people, and also corporate services with banks, mortgage companies, and real estate agents. And so they would refer clients to us. Most of the time, we didn't even see the client unless they needed long-term services. And back in the early 2000s, you know, you had to have a credit score of 750, 800, 850 in order to be able to get a loan to purchase a house. And then I started noticing the guidelines started getting looser and more loose and more loose and more loose. And it got to a point where you could have a credit score of 400, you know, and all you needed was a pay stub and a heartbeat. And I thought that was the weirdest thing. And I remember back in, you know, 2005, 2006, and, you know, realtors and banks and mortgage companies would refer clients to me. Like I said, we would never see them, but I would get the documentation, and I would be like, these people, based on what I'm seeing, can't afford this house. And, you know, back then, people were buying million-dollar houses, and they only been on their job a month. And but then they had all these new creative mortgages and all kinds of stuff, and I was absolutely against that aspect. And my motto back then was, if you can't pay cash for your house, then you don't need it. And that was a paramount important statement that I made over and over and over again, because I noticed those guidelines changing, and the price of the houses was getting higher and higher, and the loans were getting more and more creative. And moving right along, some people did things that they, and I go more into it in my book. I really have never really went into it in other interviews, but since we are 2 hours here. But some people did things with my services that I was not aware of. And when you left out my office door, you know, I don't know what you're doing. You know, you know, I was licensed by the state of Maryland, registered with the Better Business Bureau, or like I said, a member of Equifax Transition Union Experience. I had great relationships with the five major banks. I had great relationships with over 2,000 creditors. So, you know, we had a great relationship. Our Better Business Bureau rating was an A, never had a complaint, never been sued or anything like that. And I remember the first time that I was rated, and that was in 2011. And I remember, you know, and I had corporate attorneys that helped me create my business, by the way. And I had a CPA that had been my CPA for years. I had a whole Methodist bookkeeper that was my bookkeeper for about 8 or 10 years, which came from my attorney's office. And I mean, I had a sound team of professionals that was, we were working together and creating great things in the community that was dealing with credit. So when they first rated me, they seized my assets. They saw that, you know, and I was a saver. And that was another thing that I preached, save your money, save your money, save your money. So they saw I had a large amount of money in the bank that had been collected on for years and taxes paid on for years. And, you know, the bank statements matched the QuickBooks matched the tax returns, everything matched. And I ran a clean business. And I remember my attorney and I going up to see the feds, and they said, well, you know, you haven't broken any statute, codes, or laws, but we're going to go through your books one more time. And I was relieved. I'm like, okay, great. You know, this sounds wonderful. And then 1 year went by, 2 years went by, and then I became the housing chair for Prince George's County NAACP in the meantime. And I wasn't worried about the fact of the feds because I knew that I hadn't done anything wrong. And it was just a matter of time for them to give me my money back, and they would see that it was a terrible mistake. So me becoming the housing chair for Prince George's County, Maryland, NAACP, my position was surrounding the illegal foreclosures that was going on in Prince George's County. Not to mention, it was emphatically going on around the United States. So I was able to, with, you know, being the NAACP housing chair and, you know, and having political influence, I was able to save a lot of people or families from illegal foreclosure. And I did that merely by contacting the president, the vice president of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the five major banks. I already had a relationship with the bank. And so I was able to get, you know, these families' homes back, and for them, for the banks, and for, you know, Fannie Mae and them to prove that this was a good, legitimate foreclosure. And they never could do that. So then I was asked to be the housing chair for the state conference, NAACP of Maryland, because I was doing such a great job in making moves to keep these families in their homes and keep these families together. And I accepted that position, not knowing that it was going to piss a lot of people off. Mm-hmm. But I took that position. I took it seriously. You know, I had my publicist and I, we started, you know, hitting every media station that we could think of, you know, asking the governor and the state's attorney for a moratorium to freeze the illegal foreclosures that was going on in the state of Maryland. Not to mention, you know, I orchestrated and organized a march on Annapolis, you know, saying that, you know, we, you know, want to keep our homes. And that these foreclosures were wrong. And a lot of families had scores of 800 and 850 and things of that nature, they didn't need subprime lending. And a lot of these real estate agents and mortgage companies put these families in subprime mortgages and or creative mortgages that was unconstitutional. And it was just set up. To me, it was a system that was designed to do exactly what it was done and to do exactly what it did. And the first thing that happened was Wall Street failed. And I remember, you know, me and about maybe 10 or 12 12th graders, you know, I got the parents' permission and we took a road trip to New York. We went to Wall Street and we filmed. I had my camera crew with us. We created a documentary called The Signs of the Time. And the student was just amazed. And we interviewed, you know, people. And I had the 12th graders interviewing people. And next thing we know, of course, Wall Street got bailed out. And then that was the first issue. And then the second issue was the fact that, you know, the people started losing their retirement and their 401ks. And then, you know, that was all part of the Wall Street thing of being bailed out. And then the third thing came was the housing boom. And the banks got bailed out. So here it is, you know, Americans did not get bailed out. They lost their retirement. They lost their 401k. And now everybody's losing their home that was caught up in those subprime mortgages and those creative loans that they did not need. And it was really a horrible thing to see. Because I went several times to the woods and I had to get permission from the people in the woods to come to the woods to talk to them and bring them grocery store gift cards and to find out what exactly happened to them. And me going on the news telling their stories and things of that nature. Next thing I know, I received a phone call from one of the most powerful men in Maryland at that time. And they wanted me to go back on the news to say that I made a mistake and that Maryland didn't have any issues like that. And I told that person and his bully that I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't on a lot. I wasn't going to do that. There's no way that I could go back on the news and say I'm recanting my story. I was wrong when the whole United States was going through foreclosures, illegal foreclosures. And around that time, I got raided again. And before that raid, I was being followed by feds. Watched them following me. I was being followed by the bank investigators. When I would give speeches, you know, men with suits on, you know, white men with suits on would come in and they would come up to the front and take pictures of me. It was a very scary thing. Thank you. It was a very scary thing. And I mean, I lived alone. And, you know, and I'm a lady. And I remember I kept telling the NAACP, hey, they're following me. They're running me off the road. They're coming in my home, in my office, in the middle of the night. They're doing this, they're doing that. I need bodyguard. I need a driver. I need help. And I was trying to figure out back then, I don't know why they won't help me. All the time, the NAACP was really using me to create memento. And I think that's the word that I'm looking for. And they were, I believe, They were cutting backdoor deals at my sweat and my blood and my energy and my frequency and my tears, with me not knowing that that's what they were doing. And I was raided again, And this time I was arrested. And I remember them banging on my door. I remember hearing the bang on the door, and I looked out my window and I saw all of these white men running through my yard with guns. I'm like, oh my God. And I went to the bathroom and I brushed my teeth. I didn't change, I don't know why I didn't put my night, my robe on. And I went downstairs with my nightgown on. I think I was in a state of shock. And, you know, I took a swallow sip and I opened up the door. And then when I opened the door, they busted the door open. They threw me up against the wall and they said that I wasn't cooperating. And I'm like, I have been cooperating. What are you talking about? You know, you guys been in contact with my attorney. What's going on here? And it was all men, it was one Caucasian woman. And they were trying to drag me out the door with this little nightie that I had on. They were trying to drag me out the door. And they had guns to my head and they were saying, who else is here with you? And I'm like, I'm here alone. I'm here by myself. And I remember the woman speaking up and she begged them, please, let me take her upstairs to put some clothes on, please. And she had to literally beg them. And we went upstairs, you know, and I remember her, she just kept telling me, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And I still didn't comprehend what was actually happening. She just kept telling me that she was so sorry. And I got myself together and went on back downstairs and they handcuffed me and my neighbors was outside. They put me in the back seat and they took me to Greenbelt, Maryland Federal Courthouse. And I had never been in this experience before. And they put me in a cell. And when I walked in, I remember seeing this Tanzanian African that I threw out of my office. And by this time, we're in 2014, I think, or 2013, 2014. But I remember him out my office in 2007. And I threw him out my office, him and his partner, because when I hit, and I would never see their clients, and like I said, it was no big deal with the corporate accounts, with the bank, with the mortgage company, with the realtor. Normally, I never saw their clients. And so in this case, I remember back then putting the information in the system, in Equifax or one of their systems, and it came back that the person was deceased. And I'm like, yo, this person's information just came back to their deceased. And I'm like, you know, and I threw him out my office and I told him, don't you ever come back here. And I remember when I was walking, when they had me handcuffed and I was walking inside the cell and I saw him. And then they put me in the last cell at the end. And then it was two African women that was in the cell beside me. And I asked the two women, because they were talking to the African named Edgar, but they were speaking in their own language. And I asked them, I said, excuse me, ma'am, I said, do either one of y'all know me? And they both of the females said no. And I said, can you please ask Edgar what is going on? And so they asked him in their language. And then, of course, he told them to tell me, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, you know. And I'm like, well, what is going on? And then by that time, my attorney had got there. And I had to go into the courtroom. And which I didn't know what was happening, but that was a bond training or a bond review or something to that effect. And they were naming all these addresses and houses. And my attorney whispered to me and said, do you know anything about these houses? I'm like, no, I don't know anything about this. And so, of course, I got out on PR. I didn't have to pay anything. Objectively, I had to go through pretrial. You know, I had to do that, but, you know, I was able to get out. And I went home, got myself together, and I was, you know, back in their office the next day. I mean, life had to go on. That's pretty much that aspect of it. Ultimately, they offered me a plea for 30 years. And I told them that I don't, tell me what did I do? And they were like, tell us what did you do? I'm like, tell me what did I do? I didn't do anything. And they were like, tell us what you did. And I'm like, well, why would I take a plea for 30 years and I haven't done nothing and you're not telling me what I did? And they just said, okay, tell us what you did. And I'm like, we went back and forth for like an hour. You tell me what did I do? You know? That was a mess, but of course I refused to take a plea, and I was scared, but I wasn't scared enough to lie on myself and say I did something when I didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. That didn't make sense. And then some months later, they came back with another plea, and I don't remember what that plea was for. By that time, I had a nervous breakdown, and I really didn't tell a lot of people what I was going through. Objectively, what the court did do, they ordered that I see their therapist. And I remember my primary doctor telling me, I don't trust them. I need you to go see my friend who's a therapist. And she wrote the therapist's name down and number. And I said, no, I'm good. It's okay because I did not fathom that our country or our government operates the way that it operates. And let me say something to everyone that's listening. You can't get more patriotic than me and my family. I come from a family of military. My grandfather, great-grandfather, father, uncle, brother, niece, nephew, daughter, you know, not to mention, you know, with me, you know, being, you know, part Cherokee, part Seminole, part Irish, Dutch, English, you know, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Benjamin Harrison, who helped draft the Declaration of Independence. And his son became the 9th president of the United States, and his grandson became the 23rd president of the United States. So me and my family believed in what this country stood for. And not to mention on the Native side, we understood that, you know, I grew up understanding that my people were already here. So there's no way that I'm going to do something that's going to hurt the United States or hurt America or hurt anyone. So with my bloodline, you can't get no more patriotic than that. And so to be accused of, you know, they ultimately came up with 24 counts of mortgage, bank, and wire fraud, and they slid me into a case with 14 Tanzanian Africans, and they all took a plea except me. It's to this day, it's still insulting. And but, you know,
you know,
here we are.
They
offered me a third plea, and the third plea was like 10 years, 10 and a half years, or something like that. And I refused. I'm like, let's go to trial. Still not understanding how this injustice system works. I'm like, I'm going to trial. You know, I'm going to have a jury of my peers, and it's going to be okay. And then, you know, and I had went through like three different high-profile attorneys, and the fourth attorney, which was a high-profile attorney also, but he was court-appointed because I fired each attorney. And I kept firing them because they would start off with, we got this, you know, we can beat this, and then next thing I know, they would say, yo, we need to take a plea. Take a plea for what? Like, I didn't do this. Take a plea for what? Why am I taking a plea? I refuse to take a plea. And mean, I even had a judge, not my judge, but I even had a judge from Maryland step down off the bench, take his roll ball, walk through the parking lot, get in his car, drive to my office, and beg me to take a plea. And he told me that he was afraid of what they were going to do to me. And I said to him that I'm afraid too, but as a practicing Buddhist, I can't lie on my coat and say I did something when I didn't do anything. And it's funny because he and I, you know, we know some of the same people. And I had a conversation with another retired judge just about 2 months ago. We had talked in a while. And he was like, yeah, I talked to the judge, blah, blah, blah. And he said that he told you that because he said you came to his office. I said, that's a lie. And he told you that because they had so much evidence on you. I said, that's a lie also. I said, but I know that's your friend. I said, it's your choice whether you're going to believe me or you're going to believe him. I said, but he's a liar. And anyway, moving right along. After I signed the third attorney, I started, because at that point I was just so desperate to save myself, and everybody was seemed like they was just working with the feds, and they were so against me. So I started going online, filing, you know, printing up military documentation and filing that with the United States President and the Vice President and the Secretary of the United States. And I mean, all the way down the line, hey, the feds are committing fraud on me. You know, the prosecutor is lying on me. You know, this judge that's residing over this case, they're already trading the indictment on Wall Street, and I'm not even in jail yet. You know, I mean, I found on everybody. I was terrified. I was fighting for my life, and I could trust nobody. The NAACP, had backed up. They wouldn't do anything. I mean, I was literally fighting this by myself. And so I remember that fourth attorney who was court appointed, and I refused to talk to him. And I remember, you know, because, you know, I could keep coming to these court hearings, but they never would give me an evidentiary hearing to prove that my money was clean. And they called it substitute assets. And that's illegal to take people's assets when it's not tied to a crime. But I remember that fourth attorney whispered in my ear, and he said, look, the military sent me to help them. That time I'm speaking to Coco Buff and fighting for my life. And he whispered in my ear, and he said, the military sent me to help you. I'm here to help you. I'm here to help you. And by that time, I was wore out. I was terrified. Not enough to say please, but I was terrified. They were following me. They were running in and out my yard. I would see them like coming in and out my yard at night. I mean, it was just a horrible experience. And I just let him represent me, but he really didn't represent me. He just turned me over to them. And the trial supposedly had lasted like 8 days or something like that. And so I had people coming to speak on my behalf that following week. I remember that Thursday, this was in 2015, February 2015, a veil of night. It was really cold, and it was snow up to our knees, and it was really cold, and I had on a meat coat and my purse and my jewelry, and that was me back then. And that Thursday, he whispered in my ear. Now, keep in mind, I got court next week coming up. I have people coming to speak on my behalf next week. So he whispered in my ear that Thursday, the bailiff, after you go through the metal detector, and he said, don't wear that coat tomorrow. Don't bring that bag, and don't wear that jewelry. And so I looked at him, and he stretched his eyes at me. And I'm like, I know you don't mean what I think he means, because the trial don't end next week. And I look back at him, and he's looking at me like, don't do it. And so that Friday came, they stopped the trial. And they said that they were going into deliberation. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm telling the attorney, we got people coming next week to testify on my behalf. What's going on? My CPA is coming, my computer guy's coming, my business is coming in, that's coming. What's going on? And they deliberated about an hour or hour and a half, and they found me guilty on all 24 counts of mortgage bank and wire fraud. And for 5 days, I sat in that courtroom, and they were just showing all these mortgage documents that I had never seen before in my life. And they did show after credit report, after I worked on their credit, but they didn't show the before credit reports with all the junk on there. And that wasn't a good thing. That wasn't a good thing. Because they framed me in a situation like I was part of the fraud. And even the two head applicants got on the stand and they said she's not part of our Panamanian community, nor did she financially benefit, and nor did she know about our scam. And then one of them said, well, she did know that we were realtors. So I worked with real estate agents all around the United States. And then the other one said, well, she did know that she did work on our client credit. And I'm like, okay, I was licensed by the state of Maryland, and I was insured, I was bonded, I was this, I was that. You know, my attorney helped me, you know, create my business. And at that point, you know, one of the attorneys was now a judge in Maryland. And so I just knew that there was no way that they were going to find me guilty. And I remember I got a phone call a couple of weeks ago by a really rude host of another show. And he was telling me how, the 25 people came and testified against you. I said, that's not gonna happen. I said, if you're reading the transcript and it says 25 people came and testified for the government, that did happen. But most of them were banks and mortgage companies talking about the loan documents that I had nothing to do with. And then he went on saying some other stuff to me a couple of weeks ago that kind of blew my mind. But at the end of the day, they came back an hour, hour and a half later, the jury found me guilty on 24 counts. They already knew what they were going to do because that bailiff had already warned me a day before, but I didn't believe what he was trying to say to me. However, I got up that morning, Friday morning, and I didn't wear my meat coat. I didn't wear my jewelry. I did bring my bag. And because I'm like, maybe I'm just being paranoid. And when they got to that 24th count, that's when marshals came out of everywhere, and they jumped over chairs, they jumped around chairs, and they said, you know, we're arresting you right now. And then the prosecutor said, you know, she's ISIS, she's a terrorist. And I'm like, wait a minute. Well, wait a minute, what's going on? We go to the same country club. We hang out at the Christmas party with the judges and with the prosecutor. What's going on here? Y'all know me. Wait a minute. What's going on? Not knowing that I wasn't going back home for 3 years and a month.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Carbonet. Boy, that's We appreciate the insightfulness.
The judge had me arrested. And they did some really strange things, you know, stripped down and all kinds of bad, but I had nothing bad. And they took me to Deacon Parish. They took me across state line into jail, and they put me in a mental health unit. And without me knowing at time, it was a court order for me to stay in that cell for 4.5 months until sentencing. And in that cell, there was human fecal matter all over the walls, all over the floors, stench of urine. And I remember hearing these women scream and yell and beat on the walls and the doors, and they was just these strange animal screams. And I remember dropping to my knees, and I yelled out, "Elo, Elo, Lama Sabachthani, Elo, Elo, Lama Sabachthani," which means, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" And I just kept saying that over and over again. And I remember the universe or God saying to me, "You're the only person that can do this." And I remember crying out loud saying, "I can't do this. I gotta go home. I gotta go home. I can't stay here. I gotta go home. I can't do this. Do what? Do what? Do what?" And then this silence came, and all the women that were screaming and yelling and making animal noises and beating on the doors and the walls, it was this silence that I'll never forget. And then I remember sitting there, and it was so cold, and the snow, there was so much snow coming down, and I got a knock on the cell door. And it was this guard, and she said, "You don't know me, but my name is so-and-so-and-so, and your friend Roland, I'm his sister-in-law. And he has your purse, and he's contacted your sisters, and they're on their way up from South Carolina." And I remember thinking, my sister's living in South Carolina. How are you going to get through the snow? Because it doesn't snow in Columbia like that. So how are you going to get through the snow? Oh, my God. But they found me. They know, you know. And it's just still raw, even though it was 2015. It's still difficult. Then they got there, and then they was having problems getting in because the visitation was only on Mondays, I think, and so some phone calls had to be made to a couple of congressmen, and they was able to get in to see me, and they had to, you know, move my office and handle as much as they could handle with my business, because I wasn't given the deference to handle my business affairs or my personal affairs. And
let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Doctor, and I hope that echo's gone. I had to switch over to a third mic, but you gave us a lot to really think about, and to a lot of us, it's familiar. To a lot of us, we've heard it before. And I was listening to you speak of what happened to you, and I couldn't help but think about when the mortgage bubble crashed, when that whole thing went down. And Isidoro's here with us, so that's my our resident expert up there. And maybe I missed it, but I don't remember a whole lot of people going to jail when that happened at all. In fact, if I remember correctly, we bailed out quite a few banks and some larger real estate entities. And then the other thing, and we'll hopefully go into it later, that in reading your story, as I research your story, you know, I looked at what you were doing, and in the community you were doing it in, the low-income community, the struggling middle-class community. And we all know that, you know, back in the late 80s or early 80s, there was white flight. Everybody ran to the suburbs. Well, they left the land typically along the river, or if we want to talk about Maryland, along the bay, was left to the poor people. But then late, middle 2000s, the trend was to come back in and build loft apartments and live with a bistro underneath on the river or Maryland on the bay. And so you have to get this land, but there's already these people here. And so when these people are getting a modicum of financial stability, some sound advice, getting a hold of the finances to where they can manage the little bit that they have, that is counterproductive to gentrification, which does exist in America, which I have termed antebellum reconstruction because they like to call it reconstruction, not gentrification, but it tends to always favor the rich, no matter what color the rich may be. And that I think that a lot of people miss that. That's something for me that in me researching, and I started looking at why her, you know, why this lady, and then it led me to the mortgage collapse with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and nobody went to jail on that thing. I mean, but yet everybody came after you, you know, and then the work that you do. But let me go over and see if Izzy or Joe wants to chime in or the chief, because this is fascinating. Isidore, do you wanna chime in here?
I mean, I don't really have a lot of knowledge about the financial crisis. Nothing she just said surprises me. When it goes to her to go to a plea bargain, that happens all the time. They're always pushing people to go to a plea bargain. Unfortunately, the people that are bargaining with that are usually fairly poor, so they have to take plea bargains. If they want to get back to their families, they need to make money to pay the bills and stuff, but then doing that, they wind up with records that they can never get rid of and certain things that they don't understand. That is definitely a problem. And not to be cynical, but I don't think the fact that he's black and Native American helps a lot.
Yeah.
To give it easier for them to do this.
But, you know, go ahead, Joe.
It's interesting because I did real estate in Florida, and my specialty was HUD and VA rehabs. And during what she's, the time she thought about, I'm going to jump to story real quick, but I'm going to go back to a very basic one that people don't understand. There was a guy named Ronnie Manuel, who was the head of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at the time. And at the time that she's talking about, I believe he was in the position. A lot of cases like hers happen. Even when I was in Florida, the retail market, and as she said, they were giving credit to subpar people. And that's how you get this explosion. I mean, because they couldn't pay bills, and they get trapped in these things, and then guess what they do? They abandon the property. But if we believe that's a conspiracy or such a thing as it, there it is. And there are conspiracies in some cases, I have to say yes. But again, having worked in the field of real estate, I understand exactly what you're talking about. When you apply for a mortgage, you have to submit paperwork to get lines of credit in order to establish those 780 to 600. I mean, I've seen people with almost 400 credit, which basically means you shouldn't buy bicycles. they get these mortgages. But I've also seen people who might have some of what she's talking about is credit clean, which is another whole different issue in itself. The credit cleaning really is where you go back. True story. In the city of Chicago, there used to be a store called Hope Brothers. I know none of you live there, but anyway, Hope Brothers has been closed for 38, 40 years. So my last credit report about 4 years ago,
listen what they said. Most brothers will be closed in 30 years. But that doesn't happen to everyone. So I, as to the doctor's story, I have to probably go believe it. Did she get a shaft job? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But more importantly, let me just, again, I beat this one issue to pulp all the time. Every one of those systems are tied to one other thing. It's called voting. All those judges, all the people that sit on those juries, are tied to one system that we keep getting wrong, and it's voting. I'm sorry. I know Isidore's shaking his head, but it's the truth. I'm sorry. You can't sit on the jury and not register already. You can't lay claim. You can't give jury instruction. You can't find someone innocent or guilty if you're not on a, if you're not registered voter. So that's just my opinion.
Chief, what do you think?
You know, financial stuff is really not my forte. Just by the way, Doc, I'm not federal. I'm just a local Texas officer. So it's interesting, the correlation between the housing market bust.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember just a joke that I heard people that have had formal credit moving into these luxurious homes here in Texas. And then next thing you know, 8, 10, 12 months later, they can't make the payments of foreclosing on the house. And next thing you know, you've got a whole neighborhood that looks like that. So I have that's my understanding of it. I think it's a major issue. You know, because one of the things from a law enforcement perspective, you know, listen to the doctor talk the story about, you know, the rape. I don't know what that's about as far as the actions and the defense officers. I don't know. I mean, I think a simple lock on the door would have been sufficient, but I'm not so sure about the way that they operated in handling the case. And, you know, when you start talking about Prince, was Prince George County? Is that, mm-hmm. that where there is at?
Yeah.
And even here in Texas, I don't hear so many smart things about that place. I mean, as a whole, as a government. I just have to run across a lot of stuff. They got some major problems up there from what I understand, from what I read. So some major long-term standing issues that need to be really fixed. And then the last thing I'm talking about is the court issue. I say this all the time. You need to understand, know your rights. You've got to study that stuff. Not a lot of people are going to be doing that because, you know, they just normally don't have to do it. I'd like to try to train people as far as some constitutional and arrest and seizure type laws that are through this country. People need to know that stuff. You know, if you're not educating yourself on your legal rights, you need to start doing that because you'll find yourself in a position, just as Dr. Johnson said, you didn't expect it, but all of a sudden now here you are in a situation. You know, and again, I don't blame her that she, you know, her business was not dealing with, you know, arrest and seizure or evidentiary values, things like that. But you have to know that. You have to know that information in order for yourself to keep yourself safe and know that your rights are going to be upheld. Crazy story, Dr. Thomas. I can't imagine being put in that situation at all.
You know, Chief, what's particularly scary about her story is we're in a day and age today where anybody can hack your Facebook and be you. Anybody can hack your Instagram and be you. I don't care if you're the federal government, because Lord knows they've been hacked, as the Russians. But so, I mean, to go solely alone on in and of itself. But I keep getting drawn back to why this lady and who was she. And I don't know her until I just met her. But when I started reading and researching what she was doing, not in her business so much, because the business is business. People aren't going to have a big problem with you making money. Where I found that municipalities or governments have a problem is when you start educating a segment of the public that we want to get that land cheap. You know, most of the people that I can say from my experience in my last place, I'm not going to name it, they have no idea what gentrification is, and they're going through it. You know, they have no concept and understanding of eminent domain. And I'm talking churches that, because they have access to a state route or a highway, can get eminent domain and get fair market value, and it depends on what they qualify fair market as. And I'm not a financial wizard. So I have to say, given it is Prince George's County, which I am somewhat familiar with, I know that where she's talking about, can you look at some of the property that was dilapidated, some of the low-income areas? But once again, we have to look at what is the trend in America. Move back on the water, have a bistro underneath. We want to go downstairs to Starbucks from our loft apartment. I don't care if you're black or white. Walk out and look at the beach, but you can't get it because those poor people are there. So we have to do something. Go ahead, Joe.
Let me say this about the market. If you understand, and again, using the term conspiracy, let's say we take an area and we devalue it. Let's say we go in and lower the, you know, let's use the crime rate and say the value goes down even more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of those foreclosed properties, believe it or not, still have equity in them. So, child, we get somebody that's pretty savvy. They go in a subpar market. They buy these homes and they use equity that the people that did that lost the home didn't know they had. So now, are we talking about a monetary issue? You just bail out banks that are not paying out other people.
Mm-hmm.
So does this thing grow? And I'm telling you, it does, because that's exactly what gentrification is part of. Can you tie the red line with that? You start tying in infrastructure programs with that. What do you get? So if I want you to shut up, just to make sure you don't know what the truth is, if that makes sense.
You know, Joe, when I look at policing, and I got to go to community policing because it weaves in exactly what Dr. Carmen was doing. You're going into a segment of the community. For us, community policing, we're going in from a policing aspect, a quality of life aspect in respect to crime, and we're going to attack the satellite issues, socioeconomic issues, whether it's income, whether it's housing, whatever, though we can't directly impact that. And we've said it on this show 1,000 times. Why does a community policing first? Because it works. And community policing is counterproductive for those who need crime in a certain demographic, black or white, to lower the property value for the investors to buy it cheap so that we can go to the zoning meetings, which most of us don't go to anyway, and they can have their 3 hearings, rezone that property, commercial, industrial, whichever they want to do, and then move you out, in effect. And then so when you have somebody that comes in and has a system of programs like she had there with all the boards that she was on, where she's teaching fundamental understanding of how these boards and commissions work, how funding works, how mortgages work, how savings work. These things are counterproductive to the people who want to get a demographic area at a low cost for a future investment. I'm not an investment genius, so she becomes the enemy. Am I saying that is unequivocally what happened in this situation? No. But I'm saying, is it beyond the pale? No, it absolutely isn't. And Dr. Carmen, we're sorry. Come on back in here. You're getting some of our viewpoint.
What you guys are saying are absolutely correct. One of the strange things about Prince George's County, Maryland, I love dearly, which, you know, I have now been in Washington, D.C. When I came home from the prison camp, I didn't go back into Maryland. And I was instructed not to go back into Maryland, to be exact. But anyway, the strange thing with Prince George's County, they have some of the most beautiful, huge houses. Where some of the issues came in at, and I was very vocal about it to the banks and mortgage companies and realtors, it was people on the low end that was convinced that they can afford $1 million houses or $2 million houses, and they couldn't. And so that was one thing. I was fighting, you know, the realtors, the banks, and mortgage companies. This person can't afford that. You know, look at their household budget. It's just impossible. And that's how they were able to get into these big, huge, beautiful homes and live there 3 or 4 months, and then, you know, hey, and then they were kicked out. But it was ultimately for me, when I think back in all the research that I did as the housing sheriff of the state of Maryland, because I had even more resources to investigate, it was ultimately, and it's not a conspiracy, it's a fact, I can say it's a fact, that it was designed to do what it did. And, you know, a lot of Prince George's County is a renter's market now, whereas back then, everybody was able to buy homes. But you also heard me say that it was quite a few families that was in the woods. And I was on the news talking about the families that are in the woods, and no one seemed to care. The other thing that I would suggest people do is this documentary that just came out in 2020, I think, and it's called The Con, C-O-N. And the producer is a man named Patrick LaBelle. And someone gave him my number a couple of months ago, 5 months ago or something, and he called me or texted me or whatever. So we ended up talking on the phone, and he was like, I made this documentary, and you have to see it, and I, you know, researched your story, and blah, blah, blah. So it's a 5-part documentary, something like that. And I remember looking at it, and I told him I was calling back after I finished looking at it, and it took me like 2 weeks to watch it because I had to keep stopping and crying, and I was just bawling. And this was just a couple of months ago, because everything that I knew back then, he's telling it now, and he broke it down where a little kid would understand what happened, number one. Number two, what people have to understand is the fact that the feds understood, and no one was arrested except, you know, low-hanging fruit. And, but no big real estate agencies were arrested, no bank was arrested, no mortgage company was arrested. I mean, they kept getting fined or penalized or something like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, when I think about those 12 or 14 or how many prosecutorial problems or whatever it was, when I think about that, where were the appraisers at? Where was the inspectors at?
Mm-hmm.
So, but yet you come after me because I'm teaching financial literacy, because I'm the only Negro, you know, a member of Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian back then. You know, so you come after me and say, you know, my trade lines are fake, you know, playing people's credit is fraud. Well, you licensed me to do this. You know, so my question has always been, those two heads realtors, how come the law enforcement, I can't remember the name of the whoever they worked for, why wasn't they implicated? Why wasn't it me? You know, again, the inspectors, they went out to the houses, they gave a report to the bank or the mortgage company, or the appraiser, they went out to the house. So how did I know what these people were doing? And that's the sad part about it. And that's the dangerous part about it. Because then you got to deal with that conspiracy law, which is knowingly or unknowingly. Like, you can come pick me up, and I can get in the car with you, and you got a gun in your car that's hid under the passenger seat, and I'm the passenger, and then we get pulled over, and then they can arrest me. And I don't know nothing about the gun under the car or under the seat. Like, that's dangerous. You know, that something needs to be done with that conspiracy law. That's a dangerous thing right there. And it's unconstitutional, and it's not fair. And so my thing is, y'all came after me with a vengeance. You wanted me to get 30 years. 30 years for what? And remember, back then when they offered the suit for 30 years, they didn't have anything on me. They said, you didn't break no statute, code, or law. I know that. But then, a couple of years later, was my attorney asking for my money back, and then he becoming the House Chair for the State Council of NAACP of Maryland. Okay, now she's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now this black bean is a problem. Now we'll get her. You know, and it's really a sad situation. And then moving right along with the journey of, you know, being at DC jail and you know, finally being released 8 days after being in that mental health room or cell or whatever you want to call it, the human fecal matter on the walls and floors. I had to wait till the psychiatrist came, which was the 8th day. And the psychiatrist, he was interviewing me, and he was asking me, do you want to kill yourself? Well, I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, and I'm like, well, no. And he was like, do you want to hurt anybody else? No. And then he was asking me a bunch of other questions I can't remember. And then finally, he put his ink pen down, and he looked up at me. So the whole time when I first got there, he didn't even look at me. I'm just another number. And so I guess it was the way that I was answering his question. He said, who are you? And I said, I'm inmate. They said, you got to give your inmate number. And I said, inmate number, blah, 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 whatever. And then he said, no, who are you out there? And then I said, I am the housing chair for the state conference in NAACP. I'm Dr. Carmen Johnson. I was politically hit. And then he Googled me, and then like these news interviews started coming up on me back then. And he said, you're not going to see me again. And he said, I'm going to lose my job. And he said, and he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I have a fourth order to keep you in that room for the next 4.5 months until the sentence is
wow.
And he said, I'm going to put you in general population, and I need you to fight to get out of here. And subjectively, he was asking him. I just want to say that, so I'm not anti-accident or anything like that. But he was asking. He said, I need you to fight to get out of here. And that was the first miracle that I saw. And it was quite a few of them along the way of this journey reminded me that everything was going to be okay. I just didn't know it was going to take 3 years. So I was put in general population. I was able to call my sisters and stuff like that. You know, and they fired that attorney and got new attorneys and things of that nature. Finally got the sentencing 4.5 months later. The attorney just knew that I was going to be released. I was ultimately sentenced to 54 months in a federal prison. The courtroom was packed and jammed. My sister plugged in my cell phone and called everybody in my cell phone. So 20-something people came and spoke on my behalf, my character, who I am, and that this is a terrible mistake, this is an injustice. I mean, it was no standing on it. Packs and jams in there. And my judge, I was like his second case or something. He went to Morehouse. You know, the prosecutors were trying to get, 10.5 years or something to that effect. And I ended up with 54 months. And I remember asking my attorney, how much is that? Or I couldn't function. I'm like, how much is that? And he's like, oh, it's just a little less than 4.5 years. I was no big deal for him. I'm like, oh, my God. You can't do this. And that was the next miracle because, you know, I could have got 10.5 years, but, I mean, I shouldn't have gotten no time, but, you know, I got the 54 months, took the walk of shame back to D.C. jail because I told everybody I was going home. I knew I was going home, and and that didn't happen. And then a month later, it was time for me to start my journey with transit, not knowing that that was going to be a mind blown within itself. And they first moved me to Baltimore, and I already couldn't eat the food because as a Buddhist, I have a certain diet. I eat one meal a day. I eat very healthy. And I couldn't eat the food. I was already losing weight. So I got to Baltimore, and it was even more nastier than DC jail, and we were behind plexiglass. And I would watch the, lay in the bed, and I would watch the mice run around on the floor. And I like nice things. And I, from the time I was little, I always liked pretty things and things that smelled good. And to be thrown in those type of environments, and it was very difficult. And in the meantime, my new attorney was filing for an appeal, and, you know, they were already fighting that they were filing motions, trying to get me out, and safe, you know, kind of stuff like that. That didn't work. So they, the feds, or the marshals started doing something what you call defaulting. Defaulting is when they take you from jail to jail to jail to jail, and it may take you months to get to your destination. And by the time I got to Oklahoma, that's the, I guess, the main transit for the feds, by the time I got there, I was just in a state of shock. And I was shackled from my ankles to my wrists, and they even had a black box on me. And a black box is when you're like a murderer or a rapist, a serial rapist, or something like that. And they had me like on the highest red level of dangerousness. And I couldn't believe that. But I didn't know what the black box meant until I got on the federal plane. And this girl who sat beside me, she said, "Wow, you got a box. What did you do?" And then I quickly learned what that black box meant that was connected to the chains that they had me in. And I remember standing outside waiting to back up, waiting to get on the plane. And it was rows and rows, R-O-W-S, and rows of black and tan men, black and Hispanic men, just rows and rows. And the marshals had, like, machine-type guns or rifles. I don't know anything about guns, but big, huge guns, and they had dogs. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this is slavery. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I remember it was this man. He looked Hispanic, and he was in a wheelchair. And the marshal told him to get up the stairs of the plane. You know, planes are already, the stairs are small or thin or whatever you want to call it. And they, he said, I can't walk. And one of the marshals kicked him out of his wheelchair. He fell on the ground. And I was horrified because I couldn't understand what I was looking at. And he was just dragging himself, and they were kicking him, and he was trying to drag himself up the stairs until his pants came down, his butt was showing. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It just blew my mind. It blew my mind. And I remember, you know, getting to Oklahoma, and I was listening to some of the men that were on the bus, this bus, and they were saying, you know, they were laughing about, you know, you going to the chicken shack, and the guy was like, no, I'm going to the transit, and you know, I'm going to go to the chicken shack, and I'm thinking to myself, what's a chicken shack? And of course, I don't know, I'm just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Ultimately, I ended up getting sent to And I remember, it was so weird, and I remember coming through the doors, and somehow somebody said that I was a doctor or something. I think the girl who I was sitting by on the plane must have told them, these women. And they all ran over to me, and they started showing me their sores and their scars and their bed bug bites and their rashes. And then I was like, no, I'm not that type of doctor. No. I was like, please, they block me. No, I'm not that type of doctor. I just don't know. And I remember it was like cameras everywhere. It was just this warehouse room. And the bunk beds had like three beds on top of each other. And I remember asking someone, where is the bathroom? And so I went to this open area bathroom, and there was cameras in the bathroom, and it was like 8 toilets. And it was women sitting on the top toilet. And they were sitting right, you can touch each other. And I'm standing there like in shock looking, and like, you know, one was doing number two, and one was changing their tampon, and one was masturbating, and one was, and I'm like, what in the world is going on here? And I'm looking, and the cameras are looking down on, and it was the men in the little booths that was watching, and I ran off the bathroom, and I'm like, God, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. And around that time, in 2015, a lot of activists was being killed. So here it is, I'm down here in Oklahoma, and all this strange stuff is happening. And so I just, you know, figured out where my bed was, and, you know, the women came, and they sat down beside me on the floor, and I'm like, I didn't know what to say to them, and I'm like, somebody go get a Bible, go to the back door and tell the cops. I'm like, somebody go get a Bible. And I started reading the Bible to them, and as I held my feet, and then I heard somebody call my name over the intercom, and I said, what's that? It's like they calling you, they want you to come to the front, and I'm like, why? What's going on? And the woman was like, I don't know. So I gave two or three women my sister's number, and I said, something, I'm gonna come back, call my sister. Pardon, because like I said, it was killing activists back then. And the men in the booth, the guards in the booth told me that was watching the women in the bathroom, showering in the bathroom. They said, come through the door. And I'm like, why? What's going on? It was like, come through the door. And I went through the door, and it was a sheriff, and it was a whole bunch of police officers, and it was one marshal. And the marshal said, Dr. Johnson, are you okay? And I said, yes, what's going on? And then the sheriff said, hands behind your back, we're moving you. And I'm like, where's moving me to? And I'm thinking, they're going to kill me. They're going to put me in a ditch. You know, what's going on? And I'm like, why are they moving me? And then the marshal just stopped talking to me. He only wanted to know, was I okay? And they ended up moving me to another location right around the corner, like in a little prison, like in a little jail in the police station. And, you know, then another experience. So I'm not gay. I'm not knocking nobody. My brother was gay. I'm not knocking nobody gay. So I got to this other location, and this female officer, she said, okay, you got to change your clothes. And I said, well, I just put these on. It was like jumping. She was like, you have some tears. You got to change your clothes again. And I need you to go in this little room. So I went into this teeny little room, like this classroom. And she came in, and she was like, take your clothes off. And I'm like, why do I need to take, because you got to change into this outfit. And so I took my clothes off, and she was like, give them to me. So then she started smelling underwear, and she started walking over to me, and I was thinking, oh, my God, this don't look good. I'm not getting what already happened. And then all of a sudden, this male officer banged on the door, and he said, what's going on in there? And then he opened the door, and I was shaking. I was terrified. I was shaking. And he looked at me, and he looked at her, and he looked back at me, and he said, put your clothes on, get your clothes on. And he told her to leave out. And so that was an experience that blew my mind. Anyway, make a long story short, by the time I got off in federal prison camp, I didn't know my name. I didn't know how I got there. I didn't know why I was there. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was happening. The only thing I could remember was I was Christian, which I grew up in Christianity. I was Christian, and I remember being naked and thinking about all the things that my grandmother taught me from the Cherokee Nation. So, you know, thinking of the Christian thing and the ancestors who were with me and the blood of Jesus, and that's what I grew up on. I didn't remember being a Buddhist. I didn't remember being a scholar of metaphysics. I didn't remember any of that. I didn't remember being an activist. I didn't remember none of that. And when I got there, my name was the crazy woman on Compound. And I'll stop there. Any questions? And I can tell you that by the time I left there, in 3 years and some months, my nickname was Baby Mandela.
Let me ask this, Doc, because I'll tell you, you gave that representation that people don't think they know what goes on or haven't ever experienced it. You know, you shared a lot. There's a lot in this video, and we're going to make sure we get the YouTube up, you know, today on it, because this cannot be absorbed in real time and understood. It can't be taken in one sitting, because very few people are as open as you are. But I'm amazed to go through everything you went through, which I'm sure is a lot more than you shared with us. How do you come away from giving to a community, giving to people, educating people, being done the way you were done by the system, having to endure what you had to endure, being humiliated, being stripped of everything, your finances, your possessions, your dignity, all of that? How does somebody come out from all of that and then walk back out and go, and I'm still going to help the community? That's amazing. For you to walk away from all the hell that you've been through, all the people that turned their backs, nobody there to support you, nobody there to call you, nobody gave a damn, you get framed over here, nobody cares, and then you come right back out and you say, but I'm going to help these people. With two organizations, that in and of itself is incredible. We can't even get decent people, to get involved in helping others, to include a lot of churches today. Let's just be real about it, okay? So, and here you are, having to, the shame, the humility, the deprecation, everything you went through. And I mean, in reading your story and research, I would come home from work and I'd sit down and I got Dr. Carmen Johnson coming. I got to know this. I got to know that. And I got to reading it and I got to the point where I just stopped. All the police, I've seen stuff, you know, police officer Joe's seen it. The chief has seen it. I was reading your story and I told you on the phone, there's so much with you I can really connect with. I understand. Mine was not as graphic or anything, but I know what it's like to be mad at everybody. Where were y'all? And for you to go through what you went through, and it's shameful that our government did that, whether it was you or anybody, that is shameful, because when like I said, I got to go back to the mortgage fraud. Nobody went to jail for that, but you? Really? You? In the big scheme of things, you wasn't all that. So I got to say, well, what was it about her? And it seems like sometimes when you empower people or educate people or try to get them to be better than their conditions that are legislated upon them, you become target number one, public enemy number one. How do you go back to helping the community and not have resentment? How did you make that transition? What was that like?
articles first started, it took a minute. Because when I, you know, after being drugged and strangled on the floor and jumped on by 20 white cars and being burnt on my forehead and being put under the T-5 fluorescent light, tap light, being chased around the compound, and I'll be 55 in a couple of weeks. So I'm not a young chicken. I was chased around, and they would treat me like a baby deer. And I was thrown in solitary confinement. They called it suicide watch. I mean, I went through it. So I was angry, and I was hurt when I came home. And I mean, I went to, the, you know, two congressmen and a senator was instrumental in, number one, having the place raided because my sister was sending everybody in Congress and the Senate everything that was going on at prison camp. And the abuse that me and all the other women that was going through. But when I came home, I was angry. I was hurt. I was embarrassed. And all the accolades that I had gained over the years and all the awards that I sat on, all the lives that I saved and all that kind of stuff, I was hurt. And I was suicidal. And I thought of at least I had a whole list of ways on how I was going to kill myself. And, you know, re-entering back into society, whether you are innocent or not, is a mind, excuse my language, mind thought within itself. And people don't understand that. And anybody that goes to a prison, jail, camp, or cage, they have mental health issues, whether it was for one day or 50 years. You are going to be scarred mentally the rest of your life. And whoever tells you that it was fine and they not affected, they are lying or they are insane. And so when I came home, I tried to find, you know, mental health treatment, and it was just a horrible experience, and I couldn't get, you know, my home foreclosed on, you know, at that point I had bad credit, and I couldn't deal with my creditors, couldn't handle my financial affairs, and, you know, my baby sister of 9 years had to, you know, help me get a place, and this and that, and all kinds of stuff like that. She had to really help me, you know. And most people don't have that opportunity to come home. They don't have family to assist them or help them. And then me, here it is, white collar, number one. Number two, being a professional. You know, most people that come home don't have the same issues that a professional has. You know, like I had to deal with IRS, I had to fight SSD guy. They didn't want to give me my Social Security because I'd been to a federal prison. I mean, it was a mess. And no one could help me. No reentry program could help me. And it was just hard. And I was going to kill myself. And I finally saw the movie The Police Blotter. I don't know if y'all heard of the backpack kid from New York who spent 3 years in jail and in Rikers Island or something like that. I had never heard of him. And so one day I sat on my sofa and it looked interesting, you know, I like Rosie O'Donnell, you know, Jay-Z, okay, so they were part of this project, so I decided to look at it, and this little boy saved my life, and I didn't know how the story was going to end, but watching it, they kept trying to get him to say he did something. He kept saying, I didn't do it, why would I say, wait, I didn't do it, and I'm like, wait a minute, that's my story, that's my story, and then watching him being beat up back. Watching him being beat up by inmates, which I would have never beat up by the inmates, but I was physically attacked by grown men. And to see it on film, they had him on film being beat up. And he came home and he kept saying, excuse my language, man, I'm fucked up. And I kept telling my family, I'm like, I'm fucked up. And they're like, you're fine. And everybody was just looking at the way I looked. I'm like, no, I'm messed up. And not knowing at the end of the documentary, he was going to hang himself over his bedroom window of his mother's house. And I remember just bawling, thinking I had already had written all these different ways I was going to kill myself. And it's like, suppose my sisters and my dad and my mom and my daughter drive all the way up from South Carolina, and I'm in here dead. And so I got myself together once I saw that. you know, once I saw the ending of what that looked like and the pain and suffering that his brothers and sisters and his mom went through, I had to get myself together because I didn't want to inflict pain on others because pain was inflicted on me. And then, you know, then I met this organization, Community Family Life Services, and I went there through their Secret Bureau program on how to tell your story without shame and pain and embarrassment. And so I learned how to speak. I got a speech coach from them that used to work for one of the news stations or something. So she was training about 14 of us. And so I was able to learn. The feds took my voice. The prison camp took my voice. The investigators who lied took my voice. The African who did this took my voice. My voice was gone. And then right at graduation, it was this young woman named Kiana Johnson, no Ken, and she had an organization. She had an organization called Life After Release, and she was like, "Hey, you know, somebody told me to come find you, and blah blah blah. I want you to work with me." And I'm like, "I'm not ready. I need to do this, but no." And so then she kept pounding me, saying, "Hey, I want you to be, you know, the court watch, you know, organizer at the Prince George's County District Court." And I'm like, "I can't do that. I can't go in the courtroom." Anyway, that was February 4th, 2020. I accepted, I started, and now I'm with her organization. I am the director of Court Watch Judicial Accountability. I hold 19 or 20 judges accountable for the oppression that they do to our people. And I also hold the state attorney accountable. I hold the chief of police accountable for the trumped-up charges that their police officers do and the abuse that they do to the people. Pre-trial accountable, the jail accountable, the judicial accountability, judicial committee of the delegates hold them accountable, and I hold them accountable. I got 146 or 61, something like that, volunteers that have trained under me, and including Fiona Apple, the Grammy winner, who was a dear friend of mine. But back to Ms. Kiana Johnson, she gave me an opportunity. Because there was no way that I could go and work at a job because, hey, now I'm 50-something years old. My boss is probably going to be 20-something years old. It was just all kinds of issues. But she gave me an opportunity. She gave me an opportunity to get my voice back. She gave me an opportunity to fight back. She gave me an opportunity to stand up for people that can't stand up for themselves. She gave me an opportunity to express the fact that this is an injustice system. Subjectively, this system is working exactly the way that they, whoever they is, designed it to work. And then, you know, and then a year ago, my baby sister, again, once again, who is 9 years younger than me, she forced me to start a nonprofit or found a nonprofit called Helping Ourselves to Transform, which offer re-entry programs. But we do a little bit more than just offer re-entry programs because of all the issues that I've been through in re-entry. But we also are working with other attorneys, and we got a hell of a gentleman that sits on our board named Joel Siegel, who worked under Congressman Conyers for over 12 or 13 years, and we've done lobbying and draft legislation, and of course, I've done draft legislation, so we'll be working on some re-entry draft legislation, which I got a couple of senators on the state side, on the federal side. I got a couple of congressmen that are waiting for draft legislation for re-entry. They're like, "Carmen, just put it in writing. Everything that you experience as a returning citizen that needs to be fixed, put it in writing." So we'll be getting started on doing that. Also, my biggest thing before I finish is those 9 crime act bills. Whether you're guilty or not, no one deserves to be thrown in a cage. No one deserves to be thrown in a cage and mistreated. Nobody deserves to be thrown in a cage, mistreated, mentally abused, physically abused. Everybody has a right to be innocent before they are proven guilty, and that's not how the system is set up. The system is automatically set up. You are guilty, and you got to prove that you're innocent, even when they know, even when they know you didn't do it. And that is disgusting to me. You know what I mean? So those nine crime act bills that start from 1968 to 1994 have created a mass wave of mass incarceration on black and brown people. It has destroyed families. And, you know, the sad part, and I'm not Democrat, I'm not Republican, I'm not either one of them. That's not what I am. But what I can say is, our president of the United States, our chief and commanding officer, helped wrote, co-wrote, or sponsored at least six of them. At least six of them that are keeping people in a state of involuntary servitude and slavery, because that's exactly what it is. Not to mention, when you come home, you're still enslaved. They put 2.4 million restitution on my head when the two Africans said she didn't financially benefit from this. She didn't know about the scam. Today I'm working with a group of women that will be fighting that draconian restitution. Like, okay, so if this restitution was supposed to go to the bank, my attorney investigated that all those properties, the bank got their money back. You know what I mean? I did the Supreme Court twice. She lost last month, well, 6 weeks ago or something like that. People say, how are you okay? And she just lost. It's part of the process. It's part of the process. So my biggest thing is what keeps me going is I don't want nobody else to go through what I went through.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want no one else. And Jim, you are absolutely right. People should be teaching their families. I remember as a little girl, and my mother, you know, she would go through our homework. She would ask us how our day was. We would read the Bible and we would pray before we go to bed. What was missing? She should have been teaching us about criminal law, but she wasn't thinking her children were going to ever experience something like that. So in 2021, we should be teaching our children from kindergarten about criminal law and what your rights are and about the Constitution. That's what helping ourselves transform.
Before this time is flying, we're at like the 20-minute mark, you know, I'm not going to let you go without talking about the book. I got to know about the book. Where can people get it? Where? Because I'm telling you, there are going to be folks that are going to be messaging me. How do I get the book, and how do we get your story is so compelling. And it's like you describe it, it's like, you're like, we're there. And, I mean, just the book. Tell us about the book and where we can get it.
Well, we're waiting on Joe Brown to finish the book. And my publisher just came back from COVID. He had COVID for 3 weeks. So that's delayed. COVID is dropping in September. We're in September now, so that's looking at October. But they can search my nonprofit website, Helping Ourselves to Transform, and send me an email. And there's a phone number that they can certainly call. But my friend who just came back, he's saying that we should have pre-order ready in the next week or two.
Okay.
I'm excited because the book is going to blow your mind. I go more in detail than who the actual players were that actually politically hit me. And there's no such thing as a conspiracy, Mr. Joseph. You're absolutely right.
I'm going to make sure I post the links. When I put the YouTube together, we're going to have the links in there. Wow. I mean, I'm floored. You know, this is probably, for me, one of the most insightful shows we've ever done. That the amount of detail, you're very candid with us. You know, I mean, most of the time when I tell people, well, just be down to earth and be yourself, you know, they don't go where you went, you know. And I appreciate you. You know, now, we love you. We support you. You're always good here. You know, you're always good here, especially with your progress that you're making. We want to always stay in touch with you. And I appreciate you taking the time out to be on the phone with me and going through all that, meeting me and me meeting you and making time out. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, we had planned this, and you know, took the time out to do it. So it wasn't where I just called yesterday and you said, yeah, I'll do it. So I appreciate you, and I'm going to let the guys have a final word before we go back to you to close us out. Izzy, Chief, Joe, the floor is open. Wow. Everybody's like me. All right, I'll roll call. Chief.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for everybody else. It's very interesting show. You know, very interesting story. I mean, I'm going to go back and say again, you know, I agree with Dr. Donaldson. We should begin, you know, teaching younger and younger about your rights and Constitution. You know, I know you probably will disagree with me, it doesn't make a difference, but I think that it does. But I actually do believe that's very important, that information is shared. So you don't get jammed up in a situation like this. You know, when you're doing what you believe is right, you know what you're supposed to be doing, when you're supposed to be doing, how the law operates. Not to the extent of being an attorney, but of course they're supposed to be subject matter experts in it, but you know, enough where you can get yourself by. So I agree with Dr. Dawson. I think that it's very important that we should be having those discussions, not only within your family, but you know, in school, in colleges. I think it's absolutely important.
All right, Chief. Appreciate it. I remember in school, I'm old, me and Joe. I remember we used to have this class called civics. You know, I don't know where that went. I guess they put in an extra gym class. You know, we used to have home ec too, where people, you know, kids knew how to cook and do clothes, but that's for another show. But is, come on, bro.
Yeah. Like I said, very special show. Thanks for coming, for the doctor coming on and telling us the story. Like, unfortunately, like I said, nothing he said is surprising. It's happening constantly. It's not a conspiracy. Most of the time, it's upsetting because it's. Whereas this seems to have some kind of intent behind it, a lot of it is due to just negligence, incompetence, and disinterest on the part of prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, mm-hmm. all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I agree with the Chief on education. I've always been educating if something needs to happen. We should be educating people because there's a reason that they're not. There's a purpose behind that. My classes, my civics classes, my name is called NFL government. Like, there's a reason why that stuff's being cut. Like, it serves a purpose. When I say that's closer to the silver bullet than the voting stuff that Joe talked about, that's where I get a little bit more cynical because you can vote as much as you want, but look at the candidates we got. Who are you voting for? What are they doing? What has been done? They're all hanging out in the same parties. They're all going, as he just said, they're all going to the same dinners. They're all hanging out at the same clubs. Like,
who is part of that? But whose fault is that?
You can't put that all on the foot of voters. You can't just say that because you can't be. Are you honestly suggesting that, like, people just stop voting and there's a link between, like, they stop voting and then all of their candidates just stop? And it's like, well, people aren't going to vote and they're going to run.
I think you took that a little bit far. I think you've got it backwards, my friend. And you took that way from different ways.
Hey, doctor, don't.
I still maintain that the selection is still our fault, too. I mean, the fact that they get easily co-opted is our problem. But now, in theory, should they be doing what's right? And they're right, they should be. That's our fault, but it still does not delineate from the fact that system is still the most powerful system around. But even our cadets, it's to you. But I'll also say this. That the idea that we don't know the difference between how evidence is presented in a state court, in a federal court, is a problem. Because there's a reason they kick off to a federal court, not a state. The rules of evidence, how they're presented, and how they're given, rules of discovery mm-hmm. are totally different on a federal side than the state side. Mm-hmm. So, again, we talk about certain issues. Education, I agree, no question. the falling leaves. Let's not take out the fact that the bank can be called out there is still our problem. The fact that the system doesn't work is our problem.
Hey, Joe, before I go to the doctor to take us out, let me insert this in there. I think we as voters, which I'm a very strong advocate of voting, we fail to, A, vet these people. We fail to vote intelligently. Now, here it comes. Now, Facebook, don't y'all fall out with me because I'm going to say it. We vote black as much as white folks vote white. And that don't mean you're voting for the right person. So we're not voting for the person oftentimes in the best position to help us so much as, well, I don't have time to research them. They're black, so they must be right, or they're white, so they must be. And so we are not, this is the problem with America, is full of people, a bunch of uneducated voters. They're fulfilling the act of voting, but they're misinformed, uneducated, and they're voting so strictly down party lines that they don't realize they're voting against their own values in their community. And so let me get to, I'm grabbing both of y'all on that one. I agree. Doc, we're so glad to have you. Take 2 minutes, close us out. You're going to be the final words that people are going to hear.
My closing words are the fact that you must understand that what happened to me can emphatically happen to you. And the worst thing in the whole world is to be sitting behind a jail, camp, prison, or in a cage for something that you didn't do. That is the worst ever. And number two, I give lectures at different colleges. Of course, we've been doing it by Zoom. And it's so funny because people of color that look like me and look like Joseph and look like Van, and I've gave lectures at those colleges, and they just kind of stare at me as I tell my story. And I know a couple of months ago I gave a small lecture at Yale, one of the professors and some Yale law students. And those white boys were bawling. They were crying. And so when I think about our people that look like me, I'm thinking, are we in denial that this is happening? Like, at some point, we can't keep blaming the white guy. You know what I'm saying? At some point, we have to hold ourselves responsible.
Amen.
And understand, what are we teaching our children? You know, why are we teaching our children to not care for one another? You know, like, what's really going on here? You know, so at some point, we have to clean our own backyard. And then we'll be able to deal with all the other stuff that surrounds that. And I'm just, some people are probably not going to like what I just said, but it's emphatically true. And when I think about my judge in my case, he went to Morehouse. And he saw what they were doing to me, and he allowed it to happen. You know what I mean? And I had a couple of, black attorneys who was first saying, we're going to beat this, and blah, and took my money, and he's got to take a plea now. What? That's enough. You know what I mean? So I don't know. We just need to do better. And I think one of y'all said we need to vet, people that we are getting ready to vote for. Well, of course, I can't vote now, but they need to be vet, and they need to have a proven track record that they're going to do something for the community. You know, it's disgusting that, I think about a certain congresswoman who looked like me, and she came to a protest or a march or something that we was having about releasing 1,000 women in 1,000 days, something like that a couple of months ago. And she was just really just saying her speech and going at it and how she with this and that. And I called her office and she didn't want to be bothered. And I'm like, yo, I was at this march where she spoke and she said that this is a topic that hits home to her. And she don't want something to come. She don't want to set up a meeting with me. And she looked like me. So I'm confused. And let's be clear. When this was going on with me back then, I was on every news station, and our president of the United States looked like me. So just like Trump was favorable with Channel 5, I'm sure Barack Obama had his favorite news station. I was on all those stations.
You know what, I tell you, James Baldwin said, I can't believe what you say, because I see what you do. And what many of these politicians don't do. With that, Dr. Carmen, we love you. We appreciate you being here. We're going to have you back again. And especially, you took time out. I mean, wasn't a whole lot we could really add. It was more important that the listeners hear you, not us. That was the most key segment in this show. This was your story, not our story. There are some things that I was curious about. Of course, the mortgage deal and how nobody went to jail and certain things that we all put in because we're kind of saying we feel you and why are you out here dangling by yourself? But we appreciate you. We love you. And hopefully we can get you back and you stay safe. Keep that mask on.
Yep.
God, appreciate everybody for being here. Say a prayer for John. John, a little bit under the weather, but we're all going to get through this. I'm in exciting times right now, you know. So I'll keep everybody posted. Love you guys. Everybody be safe. And Facebook, y'all have a good weekend. All right.